OYOTU.com.
Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 134 of Sign Language, and Happy New Year, even though we're almost a month into it already. A few emails that came in over the break. One from a guy called Carlos Laris, I'm assuming. Forgive me if I've mispronounced it, Carlos, who's writing to me from Venezuela. And he said, "Hello, Bruce. I'm writing from Caracas in Venezuela. I've been a big fan of sign language for years, so let me start by saying how happy I am to see that you're back on the podcasting game. I found episode 131 to be extremely inspiring for me, and I'd like to explain to you why that is. My country is going through a very difficult time economically, socially, and politically, so I'm currently giving a serious thought to the idea of moving from Venezuela to Australia. Most of the people that move to Australia from Venezuela go to study something, mostly English courses or a second career in a university, that allows them to work at the same time. Of course, the jobs they get are usually in restaurants as waiters or in small stores as salesmen. While I don't mind doing that kind of work for a little while, my main goal is to find a job doing what I love to do, audio. I went to school, got my diploma in audio engineering here in Venezuela in 2005. Since then, I've been working non-stop. My main area of expertise is audio post-production for video and radio. I worked for almost 7 years in a national radio network where I write, produce, record, and mix all the audio material, IDs, commercials, promotions, and so on. I also worked for an audio post-production house for about 6 years doing audio for radio, TV, and film ads. I've also done my time in music recording and mixing, working for 3 years in a government complex dedicated to producing records for Venezuelan artists, from music production, recording, mixing, pre-mastering, mastering, replication, and distribution of the albums. So sorry if my email's getting a bit long and boring, but I wanted to give you some context so you can answer my main questions. What would you advise I do, either from here or once I land in Australia, in order to find my way into a job opportunity in audio? How is the audio industry doing right now in Australia? Are there good job opportunities? And more important, being a foreigner in your country, what are my chances of getting a job, a paid one, in radio, post, or any audio-related area? I'm really not expecting you to feature my email in your show, Bruce. I'd be blown away if you do, though. I'll be eternally grateful to you for any help you can give me by answering these questions. Congratulations for coming back from the ashes, Bruce the Phoenix Williams." Carlos Larez. Okay, Carlos, look, to answer your first question, what would I advise you to do either from where you are or here in Australia in order to find your way into a job in audio? Man, I don't know. It's tough. I think it's tough everywhere. And having been in the field temporarily as a manager of a music artist, I know that there is this common perception, well, certainly here in Australia, amongst, you know, wannabe up-and-coming artists who go, I really should just go to America. You know, if I went to America, I could make it, you know. And it's, I fell into the belief that that was true for a long time. And then, you know, through talking with people who were in the music industry, in the music production side of things, and they said, you know, that whole argument is flawed simply because if you go to America, you're a small fish in a much bigger pond. You know, there is so many more artists struggling and trying to get a break in America, and you're just another fish in that pond, you know. The fact that you're Australian, and you know, Americans tend to love Australians and love the Australian accent, that's not going to be enough to help you break as an artist, you know. And to a certain extent, I kind of feel the same way. And I'm not trying to kill your dream, Carlos. I'm just trying to be realistic, I guess. I'm not sure what your perception is that makes you think that you're going to have a better chance of finding work in Australia than you would in Venezuela. I mean, it's from based on what you've said, it sounds like you're getting work in Venezuela, where obviously you are known. You know, you've obviously built a network of contacts in the last, you know, 9 years, and that's great. And I would tend to suggest stay where you are and capitalize on that, you know, and just keep networking, keep, you know, building your reputation where you are, because the moment you move to another country, whether it's Australia or anywhere, you're suddenly a complete unknown. You know, as I mentioned in 131, you know, I toyed with the idea of getting out of audio and going into photography, and it was pretty much for the same kind of reason that I ended up giving up on that idea, because if I go into photography, I'm back at square one. I'm an unknown. I don't have a network of contacts. I mean, yes, there are people I know in the photographic industry because of the other podcast that I do, Shutters Inc. But as a working photographer, no, I have no runs on the board. I have no credibility. All I have is whatever portfolio I've put together. To take this to the next step, to get to your second question, how's the audio industry doing right now in Australia? Well, I can tell you from first-hand experience, commercial radio is really, I want to say stagnant, but I don't want you to misinterpret that. I just mean that from a job availability point of view, it is absolutely stagnant. The industry is moving ahead nicely. It's sort of, you know, it's dealing with the current economic climate pretty well. And radio in general is doing better at selling advertising than TV because of the tough economic climate. Clients who have traditionally spent money on TV, a lot of them are going, yeah, can't afford the high production cost, I'll advertise on radio instead because it's a cheaper medium. So in that respect, the radio industry is doing really well. But the job availability thing, particularly amongst production guys, who, you know, they're the crowd that I talk to the most, what I see is that no one's moving. You know, people find a job these days and they stick at it. You know, it used to be, you know, certainly when I started in the industry 20-something odd years ago, there were always jobs going. There was always someone on the move. Someone was unhappy, so they'd take a job offer somewhere else, and that made an opening at the station they'd left, and then someone would take that position from some other radio station, and so then there was a position there, you know, and it was just this constant chain reaction, and I just don't see that happening anymore. It's like all the guys that I know, particularly in Sydney, whether they love the job or not, whether they love the people they're working with or not, and the station they're working at or not, they're just staying put because it's such a hard market to be looking for work in. So, you know, sorry to sound like a real downer, but certainly, you know, like I said, commercial radio production is the kind of, you know, the area of the audio industry that I know best, and what I'm seeing at the moment is that there's not much movement. Opportunities are very thin on the ground. What was your next question? Are there good job opportunities? Covered that. And more important, being a foreigner in your country, what are my chances of getting a job, a paid one, in radio, post, or any audio-related area? Look, I don't think your nationality is necessarily going to work either against you or for you. In the sector that I work in, of commercial radio production, you're assessed based on your demo tape, you know, and if your demo tape is kicking goals, then you're as much a contender for any available job as the next guy. I don't think your nationality is going to be an issue. Command of English is obviously a critical element in commercial radio production, because you need to be able to direct voice talent, and you know, you need to have a good command of English and, you know, sentence structure and grammatical structure and all that sort of stuff. But in terms of production skills, as long as your skills are up there with the next guy going for any available gig, then you should be an equal shot at it. But like I said, the number of gigs going is really thin. As for other areas of audio, like, you know, post-production houses, television post, all those sorts of things. I have to say I'm not really up with those areas of the industry because it's just not, you know, the part of the sandbox that I play in. But I wouldn't be surprised if the same sort of issues weren't evident in those sectors as well, you know, where once people have got a good job, they tend to stick there, you know, keep their nose down, bum up, work hard, you know, and do their best work. At least that's my philosophy anyway, you know. Even when I'm having a crap day, I still, you know, dedicate myself to putting the very best I can into every single product I mix, you know, because I figure, you know, what's the old adage? You're only as good as your last, well, for on-air jocks, it was always, you're only as good as your last air check, you know, and I always feel the same way about production, you know, you're only as good as your last mix. So, yeah, that's just my two cents on it, Carlos. I know it's probably not the inspiring, uplifting response you were hoping for, but I figure, you know, better to be honest with you about my perception, you know, and it is only my perception, of the state of the industry here in Australia. Yeah, take from that what you will, matey, and in whatever you choose to do, I wish you the absolute best, you know. Look me up on SoundCloud. Just search Audio2U. I've got an account on SoundCloud, and I'm assuming you do as well. Flick me a link on there. Let me hear some of your production work. I'd love to hear it. Okay, moving on. Rob Bettler, third email. there were some interesting bits in this. A lot of it was a little bit rambling, so I'm going to jump halfway through because. Rob, some of it went straight over my head, mate. Anyway, he says, a few notes. I ran a few tests, and unfortunately the online ads on YouTube are often much louder than the videos. Online ad agencies may not always consider LKFS or RMS, or they just don't care. Granted, if the audio comes from an overweight dude recording with a low-quality mic next to his noisy gaming computer, well, audio won't be his main concern. Maybe Cheetos, Red Bull, and Kleenex. Nice. Keeping it classy as always, Rob. Nice. A note on unpaid labour. Every single podcast tutorial that has low-quality audio is asking people to work extra for free. Why? Because you have to decipher what they are saying from the noise, then their accent, then their delivery, then their ideas. Granted, accent, delivery, and ideas are universal fluctuations to every conversation and come with the territory of speaking to a new person, i.e. some peeps talk good, G-U-D, others not good. But low audio quality? Come on, I have no way to clarify or ask the person to say it louder. That is ungenerous and unforgivable, and I'm not even a Victorian audiophile. I normally just listen to one episode or less, and delete their podcast feed. I hope you can elaborate on why audio is so important. In my humble opinion, it simply kills potential new audience members. Before I carry on with Rob's email, I'm just going to address that while we're here. The thing about podcasting is it's an audio-only medium, Rob. You know, it's not, you know, certainly what I'm doing is not a video podcast, you know, it's audio only. And so the audio is absolutely critical. And I don't know if you ever listened to Building the Pod, which was the first podcast that I ever started. It was a podcast on how to use Adobe Audition. And I think fairly early in, you know, maybe the first or second episode of that podcast, and this was June 05, I made the comment of why I decided to start creating a podcast, and it was because it was May 05 when I first heard about podcasting. And I immediately was attracted to the idea of, you know, being able to find really niche content to listen to. you know, I was excited as a potential listener. I thought, oh man, this is just awesome. You know, I'm going to be able to find the kind of stuff I want to hear about, but I would never hear about on radio. And, you know, that was what got me really excited about podcasting. It was as a potential listener, not as a content creator. And in those very early days of podcasting, and you got to remember, right? I mean, Adam Curry and Dave Weiner, who were essentially the two guys who, you know, made podcasting happen. Curry came up with the idea, and it was Weiner who wrote the enclosure specification for the RSS2 protocol that enabled the idea of attachments in a, you know, a syndicated feed, you know, and it was discussions that they had that led to the development of podcasting as we know it. And that all happened in from August 04, you know. So, you know, May 05, very, very early days, I heard about it, got really excited about it, and so I went out and started looking for content to listen to. And what I found was, yeah, there was great content out there, but it was so badly recorded because people had no idea about how to do audio well, you know, from their bedrooms or their office or whatever. You know, they had no concept of acoustics, they had no concept of microphone technique, or what made a good microphone from a bad microphone. They didn't know how to mix music under voice, you know, in a listenable way. They didn't understand plosives. Yeah, there was just so much that was wrong with the content that was coming out in those really early days of podcasting. And you know, I just thought, wow, here's me as an audio engineer with a really solid understanding of Adobe Audition, which at the time was an awesome product. And my perception was, you know, lots of people are going to want to create content for podcasts. And rightly or wrongly, a whole bunch of them are going to go out and download a pirated copy of Audition, and they're not going to know how to use it well. So at the very least, I can create a podcast about how to use Audition to create good podcasts. That was what got me started. And right through all of my podcasting history, it's always been audio only. I've never dabbled in video. It's just too much work. Well, I shouldn't say never, because I think episode 100 of both Building the Pod and Sign Language, I did video podcasts, but they were one-offs and they were, you know, very much the exception to the rule. So to me, it's always been about the audio, you know, because to me, what makes podcasting so compelling is you can be doing other things and listening to a podcast. That's what makes an audio-only format so appealing to me. And I figure if it appeals to me, there's probably other people it appeals to as well. So, you know, that, I guess that's a really long way of coming back to, I hope you can elaborate on why audio is so important. You know, to me, it's the be-all and end-all. You know, having great content is absolutely important. They say, you know, content is king. I absolutely agree with that. But I believe that presentation is a very, very, very close second. And I personally don't believe you can have great content and absolutely crap presentation and expect to build any kind of audience. You know, it's got to be an equal balance, in my opinion. You can have the absolute, you know, slickest production values of any podcast known to man, if the content is crap, people aren't going to stick around. They might appreciate the fact that it's mixed well and it sounds great and, you know, great frequency response and it's, you know, all compressed and it's level and it's nice and they don't have to keep on adjusting the volume of their MP3 player. But if the content itself is not engaging or not interesting or of no value to anybody, then people aren't going to stay. So, you know, in my opinion, it's a balance between great content and great presentation. It needs to have both. And I'm not saying I always hit the mark on content. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. But I think my presentation is fairly consistent and is good. And the plethora of email that I have in my inbox would tend to suggest there are others who agree with that sentiment. So that's as much soapboxing as I'll do tonight. Yeah, it simply kills potential new audience members. Absolutely. Like I said, that's exactly what, you know, got me started with podcasting, was the fact that I would listen to this content and go, oh my God, I'm sure the content is great, but the presentation is just so bad, I cannot persist with it, you know? And then I went through, you know, 3-4 podcasts of content that I potentially could have been really interested in, but the presentation was just so bad, it was like, nah, pass. I'll wait until people get their act together, and in the meantime, I'll do what I can to help them, you know? So that's where it all started. Anyway, moving on with Rob's email. Suggestion: how about interviewing the Kokos staff? For those who don't know, Kokos is the name of the company who produce the digital audio software that I now use at home, which is called Reaper. I'm sure Justin Frankel, Christoph Theobald, or John Schwartz would consider making themselves available to a pro bono evangelist. Actually, they should pay you for the interview, but life is unfair. Those guys are very pro open source and may be open to promotion. I doubt they're divas. If they are, most likely they're never bored on Fridays. See? Concise. P.S. And he's got a picture, obviously photoshopped, of a squirrel with really buff muscles. And under it he's got, me in summer. I told you I was amazing. PS2, two Jews walk into a bar and buy it. PS3, and when he woke up, the dinosaur was still there cheating on him with his wife again. PS4, haven't bought it yet. Rob, whatever drugs they got you on, mate, stay on them. They're great. Anyway, so that's it for email. I did get a Facebook message from Carol Weiss, or Weiss. Carol, forgive me, matey, I don't know how you pronounce the surnames. A couple of weeks ago, and he said, you know, thank you for the sidechain compression episode. Any chance you could talk about mid-side processing? You know, what it is, why we'd use it, and how to do it. So I thought, yep, I can handle that. I can do that. So, actually, just coming back to the sidechain compression thing, in the last month that I've, you know, not been producing sign language, I have been mucking around more using sidechaining and just, you know, getting a feel for it. And I've got to say, I love it. It's not a feature I would ever use in radio production. But when it comes to music mixing, oh, I am loving that. There's been a couple of live performance things that ARN, the company I work for, Australian Radio Network, has basically contracted. Like we had a Delta Goodrum live set. For those outside of Australia, Delta Goodrum is quite a well-known name here. She started out as an actress on a, you know, soapy, and as it turned out, she was actually quite a good singer as well, and not too ugly to look at. So she's done quite well for herself as a music artist here in Australia. So we had a live set of hers, which, you know, it was about 45 minutes of stuff. We also did a Ronan Keating live concert thing about 16 months ago, October 2012, just before his album Fires came out. And these were things that ARN paid a mobile recording unit to go and record it in multi-track format. Yeah, so they take a split of everything coming off the stage, record it all to individual tracks, probably in Pro Tools. I would then get all of the source WAV files, you know, and each WAV, you know, for each track would run, you know, 40, 50 minutes, however long the show went for, and there would be, you know, half a dozen through to 10 songs, depending on which show it was. And I would then get the job of mixing, you know, these 40, 50-minute live sets. And I, you know, I think I pull a decent music mix, but I've been revisiting some of those live sets over the Christmas New Year break. You know, it was quite quiet at work because ARN has a policy where it shuts down over the Christmas New Year period for a couple of weeks and sends everybody, you know, home for 2 weeks. But they do keep a skeleton staff on board, and in this year, or tail end of last year, I was the one who put my hand up and said, yes, I'll be the skeleton staff production guy for the network over the break, which I don't mind too much because it's fairly quiet, so you know, get to do pretty much whatever you like for the day. There's not a lot of work coming through. So I've been mucking around with the sidechain stuff and just, oh, makes such a difference. You know, just being able to get guitars right up front in the mix and be able to have your voice, you know, your vocals at a level where they're not ridiculously out the front. Yeah, you can sort of have them pulled back a little bit, but you can, you know, by side chaining the guitars with the vocal as the trigger, yeah, just makes a complete difference to the way, you know, you get that balance between just everything. Yeah, so I've really been enjoying that. No, I can't play your samples. Sorry, not yet. However, Dave and I are now working on his fifth album, and I started rattling to him the other day about, you know, oh man, you know, heard about this technique for years, never got into it, just starting to teach myself, blah blah blah. And I sent him just a rough mix of something the other day, and he was absolutely stoked. He went, man, this is just amazing. So yeah, as I get further down that path, I'll be able to play you some of Dave's stuff and show you the difference it's making. Well, just from my perspective anyway. Okay, so moving on. Mid-side processing. What is it? Essentially, I'm pretty sure I did cover this, Carol. I'm pretty sure I did. But anyway, we'll cover it again. Doesn't matter. With a stereo mix, you can essentially break it into three parts, which sounds kind of odd at first, I know, because you think, well, there's a left channel and a right channel. But there is also the middle information, right? And think of it as digital samples, you know, in a DAW, just of a stereo mix, not in the multi-track, but just imagine you had a stereo file opened up in your two-track editor of choice. Maybe it's Adobe Audition, you know. There are, for every sample, there is a value for what's happening on the left channel and a value for what's happening on the right channel. Now, whenever the two values of any given point in time are identical, then you've essentially got mono information for that one sample in time. Now, depending on the way the particular song has been mixed and depending on, you know, a whole bunch of other things, the samples either side of that one sample might also be of the same value on both the left and right channels, you know, depending on what's happening. Might be a break in the song where there's just vocal and, you know, for a second or 5 seconds or whatever, there might be a whole string of samples where the value of the samples on the left and right channel are equal for all of those samples. But then when the band kicks back in, you've got guitars that are panned left and right, and you've got drum overheads that are panned out wide, and you know, you've got all these other elements to the mix, which mean that on a sample-by-sample basis, you know, at any one moment, you might have a really high-value sample on the left channel and a really low-value sample on the right channel, or it might be the left channel's really high and the right channel's sort of halfway up. You know, things change, you know, and depending on the sample rate, it could be 44,100 times every second, and for higher sample rates, then even more often than that. So wherever you have samples of the same value for a given, you know, point in time, you've essentially got what we refer to as the middle information, right? And whenever the sample values are different between the left and the right channels, that is our side information, okay? And the whole concept of mid-side decoding and encoding is to be able to take a mix and break it apart into the mono information and the stereo information. So essentially our middle is everything that's mono within a mix. Or in other words, every sample throughout the length of that piece of audio, and we'll assume it's a 4-minute pop song, where the samples are of equal value on the left and right channels. Now, there could be whole swathes of time where there's very little that's mono. So your mono information can be, you know, quite erratic, as can be the stereo information. Again, you know, it all comes down to what's been mixed, where it's been placed in the stereo field, and to what level, and you know, all that sort of stuff. Now, why would we want to break our stereo mix apart into the mono information and the stereo information? Well, this technique was developed by mastering engineers to deal with two-track mixes that were mixed by, and let's be really harsh here, backyard cowboys who didn't know what they were doing, right? And they end up with a mix that comes to mastering that the quote-unquote mix engineer reckons, yeah, that's the final mix. But it gets to the mastering engineer, and the mastering engineer takes one listen to it and goes, oh my God, this is just all over the shop, right? Now, working with a stereo mix, there's only so much you can do. But being able to break a stereo mix apart into the mono information and the stereo information, quite often, not always, but quite often will allow the mastering engineer to do things with the vocal without affecting all of the stereo information. Now, in, you know, the majority of pop songs, and like I said, you know, this comes with a caveat that this doesn't apply all the time because it depends on how the song was mixed. But the majority of the time, your vocals are going to sit dead center, as will kick, snare, bass guitar. But things like your, you know, your other guitars, your keyboards, and the rest of the drum kit and the overheads, all that stuff tends to be panned somewhere other than dead center. You know, now it might be that it's a, you know, a keyboard synth that, you know, has all sorts of stereo information happening in it, or it might just be a mono guitar, but it's been panned to one side. So being able to separate that stereo mix into just the mono information and then separately all of the stereo information still in, you know, two-track form gives the mastering engineer the ability to do things to primarily the vocal. It might be that the mix that's come to mastering, the vocal is too loud, right? And the mastering engineer thinks this vocal needs to be dropped back into the mix. You know, or it could be the other way around. It could be that the guy who mixed it has left the vocal too low down in the mix, and the artist gets to the mastering studio with the mastering engineer and suddenly hears the song played back on really superior quality monitoring and goes, oh, that vocal really needs to be a bit louder, right? Now, sometimes you can go back to the studio and remix, sometimes you can't. And so being able to break it apart into mid and stereo means you can then take that mid information and boost it in level without affecting the stereo information. So, I mean, that's just one potential use of mid-side, you know, decode, encode. Another is to alter the EQ curve, you know, on either, you know, the mono information or the stereo information. You know, might be that the, I don't know, let's just say, for example, the overhead mics on the drum kit were maybe mixed a bit too loud, and so you got all this really ringy, splashy, you know, overheads and cymbals and crashes going off everywhere, and maybe it's just fighting with the vocal in the mix, right? So being able to separate the mono information from the stereo information means that the mastering engineer can then take, you know, could be EQ, could be compression, could be a combination of both, and tame those overheads in the stereo information, right? And it might be that he actually wants to suck out some, you know, 3 to 5K, and he can do it without having a detrimental effect on the vocal, you know, because, you know, 3 to 5K is in a range where the human vocal is going to be, you know, quite prominent in the mix, and if you scooped it out, it would become quite hollow sounding. So there's a lot of reasons why a mastering engineer might want to have access to, you know, the middle information and the stereo information in separate, you know, forms, so that he can just work on tailoring one without affecting the other. How do you do it? Okay, I will talk you through this. I'll go through this twice, because depending on what digital audio workstation you are doing this in, or hey, you could even do this on an analog console with an analog tape machine, there are different ways of approaching this, depending on whether the digital audio workstation you're working with supports single stereo tracks, or whether it's like Pro Tools that only does mono tracks. Okay, so this particular piece that I'm reading from was written by Brad Blackwood. He's a mastering engineer in Memphis, in Tennessee, and he runs his own... he used to be at Ardent Studios, and then he went out on his own and created a business called Euphonic Masters. And I remember grabbing this off his forum, six, seven... maybe 10 years ago now, but it's a great description. So he says, take your stereo track, right? So we're assuming this is the, you know, the mixed version of a track. Now, sorry, before I go on with this, I just want to reiterate that this would most often only be used by someone who's trying to prepare a track for mastering where they were not the person who mixed the song originally, because presumably if you mixed the song, you've still got the multi-track that you can go back to and, you know, tweak the mix if there's a problem with it, unless of course you've deleted your project for some crazy reason without backing it up. But, you know, most of the time this is used when someone else has done the mix, you've got to prepare it for, you know, CD or web distribution or whatever. Things need to be fixed, and, you know, just attacking the two-track mix, you know, in its completed form isn't going to give you the flexibility you need to fix whatever's wrong. Okay, so the idea is you take your stereo track and you put it on, you know, track one of your DAW, or track one and two if your DAW only supports mono tracks, right? Now, you create a duplicate of that track. So you now have either two stereo tracks or you have four mono tracks, right? And in the case of your four monos, track one's going to be your left channel, track two is going to be your right channel, track three is going to be a duplicate of your left channel, track four is going to be a duplicate of your right channel, right? So you've now got two copies of the song, sample accurate in time, okay, because you've set both of them, you know, presumably at zero in your digital audio workstation multi-track, right? So you've got two identical stereo streams. Now, in your mixer, what you want to do is pan the first instance of the song as normal stereo. So if you're using a DAW that supports stereo tracks, you know, stereo files on one track, like Reaper and Audition, you don't need to do anything, because that track is automatically playing that stereo file back in its normal stereo mode. The left information is going to the left side of the master bus. The right side information is going to the right side of the master bus. If you're working in a DAW that only supports mono tracks, then you would make sure that track one is panned hard left, track two is panned hard right. Okay, so that tracks one and two, your first instance of the stereo mix, are playing back in their normal stereo configuration. Next, what you want to do is the second instance of the song. So if you are using a DAW that supports stereo playback off one track, then on that second track, you want to set the playback to mono. Now, there are numerous ways that that can be achieved depending on what digital audio workstation you're using. It might be a case of you go to the properties for that particular source file, like in Reaper, you can hit F2, that brings up the properties for that clip, and you can choose the channel playback mode, and you can tell it downmix this to mono. It may be that the stereo playback channel has dual panners, and you might be able to then bring those two pan controls to dead center so that it plays back the left channel dead center and it plays back the right channel dead center. It may be that the channel in your DAW has a mono switch, which will essentially do the same thing for you. So depending on which digital audio workstation you're in, you just make it so that that second instance of the song plays back in mono. Now, if you're using the other type of digital audio workstation that I have been discussing, where it only plays or only allows mono information on each track, then you would make sure that track three was panned dead center, because that's the left channel of the second instance of the song, and track four, which is the second instance, or the right channel of the second instance of the song, you'll make sure that's panned dead center as well. So now we've got a stereo version of the song playing back at unity gain off our first track, or our first two tracks, depending on the configuration of your DAW. Then we've got a second version of the song, which is playing back in mono. Now, the mono version of your second instance of the song, you need to drop by 3 dB. Right? Now, if it's a single stereo file playing on one track, then you can just drop the fader of that channel by 3 dB. If you've got split mono tracks where, you know, left channel's on track 3 and right channel's on track 4, then you need to drop both of those playback faders by 3 dB. Now, we want to reverse the polarity of both tracks 3 and 4 in the dual mono configuration, or just track 2 in the instance where you've got a stereo file on track 2 playing back mono, drop 3 dB and hit the phase reversal button. Okay. I hate using the phase, calling it a phase reversal button, because technically there is a difference between phase and polarity, but most people call it a phase reversal button, so just go with me on that. Okay, we can discuss why there's a difference later. Okay, now, if all of the two tracks, or the four tracks depending on your configuration, have been kept sample accurate, what you will now hear when you press play is just the stereo information. So basically, by monoing up that second instance of the song and dropping it 3 dB, we are essentially cancelling out, because of the polarity reversal, all of the mono information. So what's playing out of the master bus is just the side information only. So what you would do then is you would bounce what you are hearing out of your main monitors. You would bounce that to your third track, or in the case of a dual mono configuration, to tracks 5 and 6, right? So you would let those two instances of the song bounce together, like mix together, so that what you end up with, either on track 3 of your stereo-capable DAW or on tracks 5 and 6 of your mono-only capable DAW, a version of the song which is just the stereo information, just the side information, okay? So that then becomes our side information that we can work with by itself. We've now got our stereo information. How do we now get our mono information? Well, what we do is we mute track 1, or in the dual mono environment, tracks 1 and 2. So now what you've got is your second instance of the song, which is still mono and 3 dB down, and our newly rendered track, which is just the side information. And if you then bounce all of that together, so tracks 2 and 3, or tracks 3, 4, 5, and 6, depending on your configuration, what you will end up with, either on track 4 in our first configuration, or on track 7 and 8 in our dual mono configuration, is just the mono information by itself. Okay, so now we've got our stereo information as one file, and our mono information as another file. So now we'll mute tracks 3 and 4, right? Because everything we've got on the last two rendered bounces is all of the information in, you know, one of them is stereo, it's all the side information, and the other one is all the mono information. Okay, so now what you would do is you would flip the polarity of the first rendered track, right? So track 3 in our all stereo DAW, or tracks 5 and 6 in our dual mono DAW, you would flip the phase reversal, polarity reversal, call it what you will, and you would then boost that track by 3 dB, right? And now, playing that track along with our mono information from either track 4 of our stereo DAW or tracks 7 and 8 from our dual mono DAW, you've now got your entire mix put back together exactly the way as it was to begin with, except it's playing from essentially three different tracks. No, that's not a good way to describe it, right? From our stereo capable DAW, you've got the stereo information playing off track 3, and you've got the mono information playing off track 4. In your dual mono DAW, you've got all your stereo information playing off 5 and 6, and all your mono information playing off 7 and 8. Either configuration still gets us back to exactly where we started, but we've got our elements separated. And the beauty then is you can then process the stereo and the mono information completely separate from each other. It might be that you want to apply, you know, maybe there wasn't enough compression added to the vocal, you know, and the vocal was too dynamic for the song. And so, you know, you could apply some compression across the mono information. And then in the course of applying some compression to that mono information, you find you lose a bit of the highs. So, you know, you might put a bit of a low shelf across the low frequencies to pull them out a bit, which, you know, in return gives the impression of increased high frequencies. Or you could boost the high frequencies, whichever flavor suits you best, to compensate for the compression. And then, you know, you can then choose how much of the stereo information, how much of the mono information. You can then basically remix your vocal, and admittedly, you're going to be getting your bass, your kick drum, your snare drum, whatever other mono information is also going to be in there, back in with the rest of the stereo information. So I hope that's been helpful, Carol, in describing the process. It's really not that complicated once you get your head around the concepts. But yeah, I'll post the text of Brad's thing that I lifted off his forum years ago in the show notes, and I'll put a link to Brad's mastering services in Memphis, assuming he's still there, and I have no reason to assume that he wouldn't be, because he clearly knew his stuff. Yeah, so full props to Brad for the content. But yeah, hopefully that's been informative and helpful. And like I said, unless you're getting content from somebody else, there's not a lot of times you'd ever need to do mid-side encoding and remixing. But you know, if you find a use for it, great. And if this has been helpful in helping you achieve that, then awesome. My job is done. Keen to hear your feedback. If anyone's got any, anything they want to add to this, please drop me an email. Nothing's changed. It's still studio@audiotou.com. And that will do it for this episode. So until I speak with you next, take care.
Sign language.
Another audiotou.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out
signlanguagepodcast.com.
Or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email studio@audiotou.com.